One of the complaints and fears among many, especially in Washington, is that, well, you have to play tough and you have to play hardball with China, because if you go into this area where you no longer view them as the enemy, you try to have win-win kind of outcomes, they'll just take advantage of it and they'll roll you over and then they will take the ascendancy over you. What do you say to that?
I would say that that is a mistake unless you're really sure that you have leverage and can follow through with that leverage. Because if this is just bluff and bluster, then the Chinese will see through it. And I think what has changed is that in the first term, Xi was a bit flummoxed by Trump, by his sudden change from aggression to very charming and very nice and how he managed things. And so Xi worked on this and decided that the way to deal with Trump in his second term, now this being one of the first meetings, was to be very, very tough and very unpredictable for the Americans, to play back at Trump his own sort of tactics of negotiation, unpredictability and toughness. So they prepared this quite well in advance, as I say. And the point is, they're not bluffing. They have the leverage and can follow through with the leverage. Whereas this tough talk that has been coming from Washington towards China, a lot of it is bluff, and a lot of it is a sort of attempt to build confidence amongst Americans and amongst the markets that really AI and the tech world is going to be, you know, the new cornucopia for America. It's going to produce, you know, all the licensing fees. America is going to dominate in this field. But the only problem with this, and the Chinese have seen it and understand it very clearly, the only problem with this is you've seen these data centers springing up. You've built 5,400, I believe, big, massive data centers churning out, managing data and information. But you don't see anyone in them. You know, they don't employ people. They are just huge data centers. But of course, the GDP in America looks as if it's growing because, you know, NVIDIA spends another $200 billion on another data center. And so the whole thing has become a really strategic big bet on this happening, and that America can dominate in the data management. And increasingly, the banks and others are beginning to say, hold on, actually, AI isn't being as useful as people thought it was. It isn't being profitable. And actually, the revenues are running at about 3% of the capital investment concern. I mean, that's not going to spin into a sort of successor to the petrodollar structure, right, for America. So there's a great deal of concern. And that's why I think that the Wall Street donors for Trump, who also would approve, if you like, of the sending a no to Mr. Trump about coming to a deal on Ukraine with Russia, to normalize with Russia. Because these were the people, I mean, who historically have always, yearned after Russian resources, would really like to see the narrative that you hear that Russia economy is actually disintegrating and getting lower and lower and lower, in the hope, that they could return to the Yeltsin years, to the 90s, when you could buy up large parts. Don't forget, I mean, these were the people. I don't say all of them, and I use my words carefully of this, but historically, some of these banks were the banks that, financed the Bolshevik Revolution in the first place. And of course, Putin knows that and understands that. So in a sense, there's a sort of contiguity between the hardline pro-Israeli donors that we all know, the Adelsons and all those others around them, Larry Ellisons and so on. Then these ones, the Wall Street faction, which are slightly different, different branch of Islam, not particularly Zionists, although they do see Israel essentially as a tool of power. They know that, you know, what power they have in the United States comes, if anything, from their control of Israel, from being, you know, the masters on the Israeli subject, because that provides them the congressional control and the control in many of the sort of institutions of the United States. So this is the sort of double thing. So yes, Trump, you can do a deal. You can do a deal with Beijing, but, you know, let's see how much you've had to give to Xi to get the deal. And right. But secondly, with a deal, normalization with Russia, no, you're not going to be allowed to do that. The quite clearly the message was, you saw the way it was cancelled and everything, you saw the message was very clear, that is not going to be allowed.
Right. And in fact, in the remainder of the time we have with you here today, I want to touch on an issue you briefly mentioned a minute ago and really directly related to what you just said here. And that is the nexus between whatever's going on with this deal with China and all the different relations and the situation in Russia, as insofar as this oil issue goes. So President Trump, just a week or so ago, levered this huge new sanctions on two Russian oil giants to say, hey, anybody who does business with them is going to have these big sanctions and tariffs put on them, etc. The primary targets were China and India. And I think I saw one comment from Trump here that said, we didn't really talk about that. So another one of the things, it's odd how that wasn't even on the agenda after this great meeting. But how do you see this? And both with China and with India, their willingness to actually concede to what Trump wants to do to not buy Russian oil. How is that going to play out?
Oh, China has already made it absolutely clear they will have. They said to America the following. They said, listen, our relations between China and Russia and with Iran are none of your business, full stop. That's what they said. Keep out of it. It's none of your business, and we will not accept it, and we will continue trading. And of course, with China doing that, India will do it. The only difference with India is that much more of their oil and gas is pipeline supplied, is ship supplied. And so we'll see, you know, a change in the shadow fleet. I mean, there's no such thing as a shadow fleet. It's just, you know, tankers go and they have a different flag one day and they change it to another flag. They fly under a different authority and then they transship at sea. And so, you know, there'll be a small sort of pause. And then I think you'll see Russia selling as much oil. And anyway, it may be a tiny bit less, but the price will be higher because of these sanctions have pushed the price up. So I know that Russia is not particularly. Just to be clear, what's really important here is, I mean, those sanctions, you know, they're not nothing, but they're not grave, and they're not, you know, in any way sort of strategically going to change the economy in a strategic way at all. But what was the red line? Well, there were two things. One was at Anchorage, the Russians understood from Trump that he would keep sanctions away from Russia to allow it to pursue a political solution. And secondly, that and that red line has been broken with these sanctions. It's not so much an economic matter. Why Russia takes it so seriously is it is a political red line that has been broken. And the second political red line was the one which was that there would be no frozen conflict on the site as it is, now it is, this is going to be a frozen conflict, which all most Russians understand is a trap that they have to avoid. And they've been in this before, Minsk, and even going back to 1918. And that treaty there where they lost Ukraine and parts of Poland and elsewhere, everyone understands. And when I was in St. Petersburg just a couple of months ago, 2-3 months, St. Petersburg is the liberal capital of Russia. I mean, you know, always connected to the West. It's, you know, there's a station, a Finnish station, Finland station is right in St. Petersburg. And there, you know, people said very clearly, listen, we've invested blood to get to this point. And we are not about to see another Minsk Accord, a deceit imposed on us so that the West can rearm and regroup in Ukraine. And that then we will have to spill more blood in 3 or 4 years' time. We just not going to accept that. Putin may not do a deal like that. It's unacceptable. We've spent enough on it. We want the thing to be completed. We want it to be done with. So, I mean, it's not a question of political affiliation or being pro-Putin or anti-Putin. This is how people feel about, you know, the threat to their children.
So let me ask you a question, because the most likely, I guess, solution for that is, which Putin has said himself here recently, in Beijing most recently, they'll just accomplish it on the battlefield. They'll take what they want by force of arms to accomplish their security needs as they see them. Or he reiterated there, they will take it at the diplomatic table. What can, as best as you can ascertain, what would a diplomatic solution look like right now that's acceptable to Russia? And let's just look at it from that perspective right now. Is there a deal that Russia would actually accept on the negotiating table to bring this to an end?
Oh, yes. I mean, and we saw it. It was the deal, which was largely inked and initialed by the Ukrainian side in Istanbul in 22. And it included the issue of neutrality and no NATO, and it included questions of troop levels and foreign troops being involved with it, and it included, if you like, guarantees that Russia and other states would give to Ukraine. And then Boris Johnson was sent by the collective security structures and said, no way, you can't normalize with Russia.
But the two issues that were the most contentious, I think, there's a lot of them, but two that may be the most hardest for the Ukraine, if not impossible, the demilitarization and the denazification. So instead of getting security guarantees from the West, they're going to get a rump military left over, like a Weimar or Weimar Republic type 100,000 troops, et cetera. And then what would a denazification look like? That may be the biggest one of all, because that would imply some sort of political change inside of Ukraine, willingly.
Well, of course. It is inevitable because, you know, really starting back in 48, 49, the British, actually started preparing. It had its old stay-behind forces that were infiltrating Russia, and they were then turned to be stay-behind forces against the Soviet Union. And those were linked with the Ukraine. Many of them were Ukrainians. I mean, that is Western Ukrainian. And so at the time of the Maidan, both CIA and MI6 carefully put in people into the police, into the military, the intelligence, and the political echelons who would be fiercely and could be counted on to be totally anti-Russian, Russophobes, and would stay with the extreme, if you like, nationalist position that you cannot deal with Russia and you cannot make an accord with Russia. So we, the West, and Britain and America, put those people in precisely to prevent an accord being signed between the two. So when it came to it, As I say, in Istanbul in 22, and when the, I mean, you can see, I mean, the Ukrainians have signed most of those papers, or at least initialed. It was never agreed, of course, but it was signed off by them. You know, the answer is no. And the one of the reasons is because those that cadre that was installed after Maidan and sort of selected from people that had a past, we're never going to, I mean, we'll never agree to this. We'll never back down. And that's why Russia keeps going on about denazification, is saying that, you know, the hatred of those people for Russia is so intense and has, you know, got a history going back so far, not Maidan, but right back into the Second World War period.
Yeah.
You know, you can't come to an agreement. And in a sense, you know, if you can't talk to the other side, if it's not possible and they won't talk to you. And I've always said that. I mean, I've been involved in many sort of peace, if you like, negotiations, ceasefires and things like that. I mean, the first thing is you've got to get to the point that Rand was making, interestingly enough, is that you have to recognize, you can say, look, I don't agree with this man, my opponent. I don't agree with him. I don't agree with his history is completely wrong. And his vision for the future, I can't accept that either. But I now accept that this person has a legitimate point of view and is a representative of his people or her people. Once you say that, then politics is possible. But if those people will not talk and will not have anything to do with Russian, and we only have to look at the history of them trying, you know, having to suppress the Russian language, suppress, you know, everything Russian during that period. I mean, the chances of being able to sit down and have a serious talk, as soon as they learn of it, it'll be stopped. So that's what he means by denazification. It's not, you know, it's not to try and sort of put a political character a category and say, you know, anyone who's on the right is not allowed. It's not that sort of, you know, European style, if you like, cordon sanitaire. It is simply saying, you know, there have to be people, Ukrainians, military, whatever, but who are able to talk and able to come to terms.
So given the history that you just talked about, I mean, let's run from MI6, CIA, going all the way back to 47, 40, 48, et cetera, that seeds that were planted then. Is there, I mean, if we're just being honest, is there even a rational possibility to get to a negotiated denazification that's acceptable to Russia? Or literally, have we baked in that Russia can only have a military victory here and be satisfied?
I see no basis, as things stand, I see no basis for a negotiated settlement involving United States and Russia about Ukraine. I see no basis for it at all. I think we're deceiving ourselves if we think it's possible. If there's a change in the circumstances, if something happens in this next period in the sort of Donbass and other areas, who knows? But at the moment, I see no prospect of it. And so, and also, given the sense that, you know, the mood in the team of Trump is now solidly against any negotiation with, not solidly, there's Witkoff, of course, but I mean, solidly against any sort of real negotiation with it. They've turned, you know, there's been a big shift. You know, not so long ago, most of the West was saying, oh, well, you know, Ukraine can win and Ukraine is going to succeed and thing. Now we've gone to the other side, is how to define failure, how to define failure as victory. I mean, you know, yes, now we can try and pretend it's victory because, you know, oh, Russia, you know, actually it's eating up their economy, this war, it's eating it up, they're getting weaker and weaker, and, you know, with time, so that it is a sort of holding exercise at victory, not this year, next year, but 3 years' time. And the Europeans sort of lap this up and say, yes, you know, we just got to put enough money aside. And then 3 years' time or something like that, Russia will be so weakened. I mean, it's nonsense, complete nonsense. It's a fabrication. It's just psyops, that's all.
Yeah. Well, that's where we are right now. And I guess we're going to have to wait and see, as you say, what could happen in the Donbass and then in both Kupiansk and in Pokrovsk, which could change the dynamic on the battlefield. We'll have to see how that plays out here in the coming period of time. But we are incredibly grateful for having you come on today, especially in talking about a lot of these issues here. And we would definitely like to send folks back to your conflicts forum, a geopolitical oracle, and on your Substack forum, because lots of great, great stuff there. And that's one of the reasons we were glad to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you very much. It was, of course, as I said at the outset, a pleasure to join you.
I look forward to having you back real soon. And we thank you guys for being with us today. And also let you know, actually less than 30 minutes from now, we've got another great international relations theorist here on this side of the pond. John Mearsheimer is going to be talking about this new nuclear arms race and just what in the hell is going on with that. I said 30 minutes. That's actually at 1 o'clock today. So about an hour and a half from now, we'll look forward to seeing you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.